We ready? Okay, so I'm Malcolm Chudnik. Pretty sure you're all in the wrong tutorial, but bad luck, no escape now. So, well, the title for this talk was fairly misleading, just to give you an idea of what you're in for, now that none of you can leave. my the door's locked, right? The plan here is to talk about the kind of problem we face as practical people not working for a large company. Like you want to set up your own website, and when I say website, I'm not talking necessarily HTML, JavaScript, CSS crap. I mean, like my interest is, I'm very much a back end sort of person, and HTTP is kind of a cool network protocol for shoveling data around, whether that be a website or a syndicated feed or whatever. So I'm more interested in the infrastructure that happens to support things you can view in your browser, but can also support other stuff. So a lot of what I'm talking about here, well, nothing I'm talking about here is going to be HTML specific or CSS specific or anything like that. This is very much, I guess the subtitle for the talk was being your own operations manager. My sort of assumed level of sysadmin knowledge is almost nothing. Like I assume you can set up your system and everything like that, but I'm not going to assume any deep knowledge. I've been kind of an operations manager for a medium-sized company doing high-performance stuff that had to be up 24/7, so I've been on the large size of things. I also run a few of my own websites and do consulting for people who happen to have things on the web, so I know what the small side of things like. And the sort of reality is, if you're going to be hosting your own website, or you're just trying to start up some application that you're hoping one day will be bought out by Yahoo or Google or something, you're not going to go out and want to spend $10,000 a month on hosting or buy 25 machines and have to manage them. You want to start out with something at WebFaction or DreamHost or what have you, and build up from there. Now, it's kind of tough about how much detail to go into as far as specifics of hosting goes, because everything's a little bit different. Like you've got on some accounts, you'll just get an account on a Unix system, essentially. You'll get your directory, and they will have set up an Apache virtual host that will point to a particular place in your home directory, and so on. On other systems, you might get a virtual private server. So it'll look like a fully installed Linux system, but you're sharing the CPU and the disk space and the memory with everyone else running on that machine. That's getting more and more common these days. Like, go back 10 years, that was impossible to get. It was basically the shared directory system was the affordable option. These days, having your own virtual machine that you can admin is reasonably affordable. And then you can go a bit further, and for a few $100 a month, you can start getting into the actual dedicated server where you have full access to the CPU. So within that gamut, though, a lot of what I'm going to talk about here today applies. So this is... if only I'd gone to this slide before I said all that, it would have reminded me. So the idea is, I'm not talking about you want to set up a dozen machines, 20 machines, something. You start off with one machine, and you want to, and maybe you've noticed, oh, I've got some performance problems, or I'm expecting to get very popular, or what happens if, trying to plan for the future. Let's assume you have no actual money, but you have a willingness or a need to want to go forwards here. I'm going to try and be a reasonable mixture of sort of practical how-to, here's what to do, and but there's a fair bit of sort of theory mixed in here, because a large amount of this is attitude is everything here. Much as with debugging, you approach it with the right attitude. Like, every problem is solvable. There's no problem that is really unsolvable at this level. You've just got to have sufficient time, the right approach, and you'll get there. So that's that last item, right? Assume you know how to tie up your shoelaces, and you've got a sufficient time to try and learn what to do, and every problem is solvable at this point. Probably worth starting at the holy grail end of things, and thinking, what do the really big guys do? What are the Googles, the Yahoos, the Slashdots, and those sort of guys do that? And what are they doing that we can learn from? Because clearly, Slashdot, SydneyMorningHerald.com, WashingtonPost.com, New York Times, all these really big sites that are sort of presentation only, but they're serving millions of visitors round the clock. They must be doing something right. So here's massive generalization, but here's a sort of back of the envelope summary of the sort of things they're doing that helps what they're doing work, besides having an application that you want to use. Bit of planning, and I'll get in more vertical design and horizontal scaling on the next couple of slides, because they're fairly generic terms that could mean anything, so I better tell you what I mean by them when I'm talking about them. But essentially thinking of design, how you're going to split things up and work out how they're going to scale it. We'll get to that first point in a minute. The second one, session management becomes a big issue as you go up from I'm the only person reading my blog to there are many people reading my blog to I want people to be able to leave comments. I now want them to be able to have an account on here so that they can actually see what comments they've left before and we can identify them and so on. Session management starts to become an issue. Session management is okay. Most of the sort of standard stuff works well with a dozen, 100, 1,000 people. Start getting a couple of 100,000 people visiting your site regularly, and you've actually got to start to think about what do you want to do with session management? Do you want to check whether, do you want everyone to have a session regardless of whether they're logged in or not? Can you afford to do that? Because you're really, with sort of session, what I'm talking about is, even things like how much information are you going to be storing in a cookie that you're passing backwards and forwards to them to ease their navigation around the sites? Is it worth having this for anonymous people or not? Session management turns out to be not a zero amount of overhead as you scale up to really large numbers. So at some point, as you get enormously popular and become a Yahoo or a Google or someone, you've got to start thinking about what am I doing there? What's worth tracking? How fast should it be? Where should it be done? And again, I'm not saying these are things that we have to worry about as the single man garage operation, but these are just the sort of things you do have to worry about if you're going to be the next LiveJournal. At some point, again, you start to realize the Earth is a big place. People are spread out fairly far. It's probably worth serving stuff as locally as possible because every now and again, a fishing trawler off the coast of Singapore rips up the cable between here and Hong Kong, and your packets between Sydney and Hong Kong start to go via Los Angeles, New York, London, and it takes a while. Staffing becomes an issue as you get bigger. Both if you're going to provide round-the-clock support, you actually need people to answer the phones, to monitor the alerts, because things go wrong, right? Machines fail all the time. The more machines you have, the more chance there is that at any given moment, one of them is going to actually have failed. You need to assess the impact, maybe deal with it. If you want to be up 24/7, this means you actually have to have staff to address that. You maybe need a sysadmin staff. Like, keeping things up and running and detecting when things go wrong is sort of an operational issue. Getting new stuff up and running, maybe repairing what's gone wrong and so on, could very well be thought of as more of a sysadmin issue. It doesn't have to be done right then, but it has to be done at some point. And again, the dividing line there is a little bit blurred. What's sysadmin, what's operational, what's developer stuff? Because again, some of your problems could come back to there's actually a development solution needed. So staffing becomes an issue. And that's sort of where you start to realize, okay, as soon as I need to hire more staff, I've become bigger than a one-man operation. I'm just hosting a quiet website. At that point, you've probably got the right sort of problems, right? You need to hire more people. You must be doing well. Get a couple of terms out of the way. And I'm really sorry for everyone who went to Stormy's keynote and saw all the lovely pictures. I don't have a lot of pictures. Sorry, it's all tight. These slides, I'll give them to the organizers, and I'll put them up on my website later on. So the idea here is the words kind of remind you what I'm talking about. For me, and I guess for a lot of people, vertical design is kind of thinking about how you split up your system with a view to being able to move things around later on. For example, take your average website. I'm going to say average website, and then you pick Slashdot as an example. But take something like Slashdot as an example. You've got your serve information up to the viewers, the stories, the comments, and so on. You've got store the information somewhere, some kind of database server or maybe file system or whatever. We'll talk about that a bit later on. But the storing of the data and then the account management, working out who has access to what, who can post stories, who can leave comments, who can do moderation, so on and so forth. The kind of business logic level. On some sites, it's very well worth splitting those up into three layers because the stuff that has to worry about actually pulling information together and presenting it is sometimes a bit different from the business logic. The business rules is quite different from the database layer. These, on a very big site, these are often split up into separate machines for the reasons we'll get to on the next slide, but it makes sense to at least intellectually think of them as being separated because then you can deal with the problems in isolation. If I've got a database problem, I don't have to worry about messing around in the HTML code. If I've got user account access permission problems, I probably don't have to worry about, is my database giving me the right records and so on. Now, this is all kind of obvious after you've done it even once. You think, well, yeah, keep things separate. But that's kind of an easy example. Take a... Flickr is sort of a good example of something that is way over the top in terms of the information that you serve. Go to a site like Flickr, you've got on the front page little snapshots of your own photos, little snapshots of your contacts photos, maybe snapshots of everyone's feed. You've got your own photos in all sorts of different sizes that people can view. There's comments, there's the account management, all of that. So Flickr, if you've read Cal Henderson's book on running high-performance websites, they talk about how many sort of little subcaching things they've got going on so that the little photos, the sort of snapshot views that almost anyone can see of your photos and the various sizes of your photos are all stored in different caches. And that's on an entirely different level to actually the raw data that you uploaded, which is stored in a different sort of data structure. And then they've got the business logic and so on. They're all split up in different levels. And every now and again, you see sort of the Flickr is down for a massage error message because one of these layers has broken, often quite near the top, and they can't serve particular pieces of information. But again, they only have to dive into particular pieces because they've split up, they've kept things nice and compartmentalized. The other advantage of doing the vertical design, and I sort of hesitate to call it vertical scaling because once you've sort of designed things in components like database layer, business layer, presentation layer for the simple sort of classic three-tier architecture, maybe there's caching layer in there and so on, it's a little bit fiddly though. You don't tend to scale out very much beyond your initial design. You might add a layer or two about the time you're getting purchased by Yahoo, but you don't tend to scale very much. I tend to think of that as vertical design from the get-go. Horizontal scaling, on the other hand, very much happens. You might have decided, okay, I've got my various layers, even if it's just presentation layer and database layer. Let's keep it simple, two things. But I'm serving a lot more pages than my database might be keeping up with things very easily, but I'm having to shunt out a lot of network traffic. Lots of page views are going on here. Let's add more web servers out the front. Again, this might not necessarily be the one-man operation. I'm still talking about the utopian world where everyone has infinite amounts of money and access to machinery and so on. But putting more machines to do the job of a single layer is very common. That's the traditional horizontal scaling method. And your different layers are going to scale at different rates and by different amounts. Actual war story time. What are we now? 2008. So 7 years ago, I helped write a piece of fairly complex system that talked to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange in real time and took live stock feeds from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and had to serve them up in various ways, historical data, charts over the days, the whole nine yards. And the Hong Kong Stock Exchange is reasonably busy. It's fifth largest or sixth largest now stock exchange in the world in terms of the amount of transactions going on backwards and forwards. So we had to write something that kept up fairly rapidly. And this was a system that you've got very rapid amounts of data coming in the back end. Like, we actually did a three-tier sort of design where the database was the middle layer, which is a bit unusual because we thought of the bottom layer as the section that talks to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. All the data's coming in there, it gets processed, turned into a format that is then ready to be pushed up and put into the database. Then at the front end, you've got all of the users for this particular customer who is using this operation, querying the data in various forms, giving different views over this data. And that was also insanely busy. But they were busy in different ways because, of course, your people are coming in and viewing the data, very much a read-only view. This trading was done via another path in this system. But people tended to come in consistently through the day at various times, starting at about 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and then going through the day. There was a bit of a peak at lunchtime. There was a bit of a peak late in the evening in this particular place. Whereas the data from the stock exchange would come in a couple of humps through the day. You'd get about 50% of your traffic in the first half hour of the day. And then the rest of the day, so the peaks were something like 10 times the mean amount of data that we're getting in terms of volumes. This system started out being a fairly simple two presentation systems, two database systems, two systems for talking to the stock exchange. Mostly two, we only needed one in a lot of cases, but two is because, again, stuff happens, machines break. So we could lose one and we were still okay. But then we very rapidly had to scale a number of database systems because the database layer was being flattened because it was very contentious. You were getting a lot of writes going in at the same time as you were getting a lot of reads coming out. And rather than make a more complicated database layer, it turned out we could just add more database machines and spread the load over things a bit more and ease the load off. But we still only, we didn't even need very many of the presentation servers, the machines actually talking that the customers would talk to. because it turned out that Moore's Law sort of helped us out there. As they got more and more customers in this business, technology kind of kept up with us. We had to replace the machines, but by the time, sort of six years later, I think the machines were about three times as fast as the machines we put in originally at the end of 2000. And we still only had three or four of them going. And again, we sometimes had six, I think we had as many as six of the presentation machines because machines kept breaking. And we really couldn't afford to be down for very long, so we had lots of spares. But being able to scale at different layers at different amounts is worth doing. And so when you're designing your next big thing, it's worth thinking about what are the bits that are going to have to scale independently of each other? And also, what are the areas that everything has to go through? And by this I mean, for example, account management is a big deal. If you've got a whole bunch of people logging in and creating accounts, everything has to go through a single point at some moment in time, because you want, if someone creates an account and then tries to log in with that account, you'd actually like it to succeed. Now you might decide, okay, all our accounts eventually get distributed out to all the databases, but this does mean at some point when they register, it has to be distributed out to all the databases and so on. So it's also worth thinking, where are the bits that, if you're doing session management again, if I've got a session, am I tied to a particular web server, database, whatever, so that I always get this particular session information, or is all of my session management done on one machine for everybody, or what's the deal here as far as scaling goes? Sometimes you can't scale things. Okay, so that's the sort of theory of what the big people do. Let's have a look at what we can do as normal human beings. And the sort of standard approach here, and this is the approach I'm taking over the next few slides, is I'm assuming we've got something, we're trying to work out how to make it better, whether preemptively or reactively. In some way, like obviously preventively is better, but reactively is easier in some ways because you actually know what's going wrong. So first thing, working out what's actually going on, whether you're doing this by predictive methods, I think this is going to happen, I've tested it all out on a virtual machine, so I've been able to test the thing to destruction, or you actually know that at some point XYZ fell over and so we need to fix that. It's scientific method, collect your data. What does the data mean? Like, my website is slow is not actually a problem report. It's a symptom, but it's not actually something you can fix. My website is slow because of boom, boom, boom is something you can work with. Your website has problems is the typical help desk phone call that comes in, and it's useless. Thank you for your report. Right? Let us know when you have some information. What were you doing? When were you doing it? What did you expect to see? Blah, blah, blah. Right? What does the data you've collected actually mean? It's taking 35 seconds to retrieve a page. Why? What can you change, right? What can we do to mitigate these factors? Do we add more machines? Do we speed up XYZ? Are we completely screwed because the network pipe is full? What can we do? And what can we do within the confines of what we've got available? This is the, what are the trade-offs? And if you haven't seen that last acronym before, you probably need to read more science fiction. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch, right? No change without consequence here. You can, again, we're assuming you have a couple of machines, maybe one machine, maybe some virtual hosting, whatever. If your system is slow because your CPU has to do so much work, okay, we need more CPU power, this might cost more money, this might need another machine, we might have to change our account, which means we might have to change our hosting provider. The domino effect is a very big deal at the one-man band operation level, because you're pretty much running at the limits or pretty close to the limits. You don't have a lot of knobs you can tweak without it having an effect on something else. So just as we're going through this, and I'm trying to instill a sort of sense of attitude here into how to approach these types of problems, keep in mind, what am I trading off when I want to do this? Which also leads to the next sort of thing of essentially, okay, this is the Zen slide for the day, but it's the don't overreact, right? Douglas Adams had the right thing. Don't panic here. No Jar Jar Binks moments. We're all going to die, right? It's what do I need to fix now? What can wait till later? But this is the sort of sense of perspective. How bad is the problem? Okay, the pages are very slow. It turns out the reason the pages are very slow is because that guy off Singapore dug up the internet cable accidentally, and it'll all be back. We're pretty sure within a couple of days everything will be back to normal. Okay, we don't have to go and panic. Everything's slow because the CPU is maxed out, and we're featuring in Wired magazine next week, and so it's going to be even more popular. Okay, panic, not the right word, but it's probably time to do something today. Keep a sense of how bad are things. This is just normal incident response, like making your website be more performance is essentially incident response on a slightly slower level. There isn't actual smoke and alarms going off, but you're trying to fix something. Be realistic about what you can do. My site has suddenly featured on Slashdot, and the Slashdot effect these days is very overrated. Like, if you can't handle Slashdot, really, it's just you need better systems. Seems that the dig effect is a little bit worse, and FARC is probably pretty serious too if you get caught there. But be realistic. If you're actually on the front page of Slashdot and your system is melting down, there's a limited number of things you can do. Put up a static copy of your site, redirect the DNS to point back at Slashdot, been done before. depends on your thing, but this isn't the moment to go buying more machines, because you're not going to be able to fix today's problem right now. And have a sense of balance about what, of all your options that you can do, are some less extreme, cheaper, less risky. These are all, it's all a balancing act. There's no, well, experience is something you get right after you need it type of thing. Yes, we maybe shouldn't have gone that particular route, but try and learn. I get a few, a bit later on, I'll keep mentioning it. It's very much worth reading every time you see a case study of how someone does this type of thing, particularly the really big guys, the Wikipedias, the live journals, whatever. There's always something in there for us little guys to learn. Like, you always see the sort of, we were doing pretty well until this happened, and you think, okay, so I'll keep that in mind if this is about to happen. eBay has some real horror stories from their early days. eBay were basically reasonably screwed on about day one with performance problems. They had some Sun engineers basically camping out there for a couple of months, fixing various problems. And again, you can say with hindsight, they probably should have done it differently. But you can also say with hindsight, it was kind of a nice problem to have, to be so popular that you needed to call in the special Sun team to fix all your problems, right? You knew you were going to be successful. So just keep a sense of perspective and be realistic about what you can hope to achieve with various problems. Again, this is predictive versus, particularly when you're being reactive here. If you're reacting to a problem, the moment has probably passed at which you can solve the problem. You're now into mitigation. Try and stop the problem from getting any worse, or at least work out how soon can I make it better. But don't expect to be able to just snap your fingers and have magic happen. If you're trying to be predictive, this is where, I guess, perspective and balance come to the fore. Don't necessarily think, wouldn't it be great if I was blindingly successful next week? Let's buy 10 more machines, because what are the odds of that actually happening? And what are the problems you're really going to be hit with? The type of... We really are down to one-man band area here. This comes down to the what is happening area of things. You've got the tools available that you need. If you're running a website, you're presumably using a web server of some description. It has logs. Your machine has syslog on it. There's all sorts of logs being generated. You've got mail logs, you've got varlog secure, whatever. Just use programs available to you. LogWatch is on almost every Linux system these days. It needs a little bit of configuration to get it to stop being so darn noisy, but it's actually pretty useful for just seeing, look, everything was very slow yesterday. Hey, look, I got hit by about 1 billion people trying to brute force the SSH accounts here. Or my mail server seems to have crapped itself, which was probably slowing everything down because it was on the same machine as the web server. Something like, the programs I'm putting up here are not necessarily best of breed. I'm kind of putting up things that are commonly available, might even be on the system now, are on various hosted accounts, things like that. So they're not too much trouble, particularly in the hosting world. If you want weird and wonderful program X, it's a little bit hard to get there. You're sometimes a little bit hostage to your hosting provider. If you've got a virtual server, like, and you're essentially being sysadmin on your own virtual system, you're in a much better situation. You can usually compile stuff or whatever. But at the same time, maybe the virtual system is, let me pick something randomly here, CentOS 4 or something, which is essentially Red Hat Enterprise Linux 3, 4. And so suddenly you've got Python 2.3, you've got some slightly older other things. Maybe it's running under user mode Linux, so you don't have NPTEL threading, and so you've got all sorts of other things. I'm speaking from bitter experience here. There's no end of things that can go wrong trying to build things. But so being aware of the common tools you've got available, and then being able to Google around and find slightly more interesting tools is a useful skill to have, a useful attitude to have. Let's use the tools we've got available. AWStats is a nice little program just for essentially summarizing web logs. It can read Apache log format, it can read Squid log format, it can read a whole bunch of reasonably common web server and proxy and caching log file formats, and gives you a nice summary. So it's a nice login. Here's a screen that shows me, the unique visitors, pages they're viewing, and so on, which is always handy to have. 404 links, which you'd get if you're using LogWatch as well, but let's find all the pages that people seem to be trying to access that they don't have yet. Is this typo in the site? Is it something broken on their end? Is it something up? Everyone seems to be going to an about page. Let's make one of those. Again, very, very commonly available. It's actually just a little CGI script, pretty handy, looks very fancy, pressures the boss no end if you're doing it at a company, and takes about, I don't know, 3 whole minutes to set up. Stat collection. This is the kind of, the first part is the log analysis. Stat collection is, again, keeping an ongoing eye on what's going on in the system with a view to analyzing it later. This is the after the event analysis, not so much keeping an eye on things. RRD tool, aka, what is it, MTR, gone through a few names and a few different variations, is basically a tool that can collect all sorts of nifty information about your system, network interface statistics, CPU load, memory usage, number of processors, all this sort of jazz. It just stores in a very simple database tool, database format, which is really a text-based database. And then you can use various tools like Cricut, or there's another one that I think comes with RRD tool that, this, again, displays very nice graphs, and at a glance you can see the system is looking very good today and there's a massive spike 2 days ago, which might explain all the problem reports I was seeing, or why was that? We ran out of memory, or suddenly I lost one of my two CPUs, or whatever, right? Just, again, it's a very handy set and forget, but it can collect a lot of information about the sort of standard stuff. Sysstat, S-A-R, is a tool that tends to come with most distributions. And again, it's a cron job that runs every 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how you set up, that just grabs a snapshot of the system. How much network traffic has changed since the last time, block I/O, CPU load, all that sort of jazz. And then you can go back and over the last month or however long you want, it writes one file per day and can present summaries of sort of, on this hour, on this day, here was what your CPU load was like, here was what your memory load is like, which is useful if your system resources are generally fairly consistently used. I found SAR to be not so useful on systems like this stock exchange system. SAR was completely useless in many levels because we tend to have very, very spiky CPU loads, and we might be completely doomed for 3 minutes out of five, and then SAR would run in one of the quiet minutes. And you go half the day without noticing that you had these sort of freaky moments, and only when you were looking much more carefully or using RRD tool or something would you notice that actually it was very spiky. Not necessarily a problem, but I'm just saying, don't know your tools a little bit, know how they run. RRD tool tends to run more frequently. I think it's 30 seconds or minute is one of the things they suggest you set it up. SAR by default, I think, runs every 10 minutes. Which is, again, the trade-off between how much information do you want to collect and have to analyze versus how important it is to collect all this information. Then there's the sort of live analysis stuff, which is the reactive, trying to work out what's going on right now on the system. It's going really badly right at the moment. What's going wrong? And a lot of these, if you've done any kind of sysadmin, I see some members of the audience are a little bit overqualified here, but a lot of these will be obvious. Some of them you may not have played around with before. Okay, and I'm not doing this to embarrass anyone, but who hasn't actually heard of VMSTAT or doesn't really know what VMSTAT does? Okay, a few people, good. So let's break out of here for a minute and just show you what's going on. VMSTAT is one of these tools that basically gives you a snapshot on the running system of what's going on. What's something that's running well? Actually, let's make this bigger. Make this. So I'm just saying every 2 seconds, give me a snapshot on the system. The first letter is P. It's cut off just the very left-hand side of the screen there. Let's make the screen a bit smaller. Good plan. Sure. Readable now? No, not. Starts with props. And the room weeps for you. Okay. So the first column is the number of running processes in any, and again, this is every 2 seconds, give me a snapshot. So in the last 2 seconds, how many processes were running? Clearly the system's under incredible load here. There's no processes running whatsoever. The second column is the number of processes that are blocked and ready to run if only they could get a chance. Now, every now and again, you look at a system, like you look at a really heavily loaded system, you say, okay, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 things that are getting run in any particular second, and there are 17 things waiting to run. Usually means you've got either you've got a ridiculous number of processes running on this box and you're completely CPU overloaded, or in a couple of cases I've seen, too many things are really waiting for the disk drives to keep up. They're trying to read stuff off disk and they're now read their information, they're willing to get another shot. I meant to print the headings every now and again, so let's just do one line so that we can talk about it. The amount of memory being used by swap, again, highly stressed laptop this one. It's not a disaster if that's not non-zero. We'll get, the problem is more these two columns which are related. How many buffers were swapped in the last time period, and how many were swapped out? If those numbers are non-zero on a heavily loaded system, okay, now stuff that would like to be talking to memory is actually talking to swap, which is on disk, so disk doesn't go quite as fast as memory. Got a little bit of a slowdown. But if there's some stuff in swap just because it's sitting there, not being used very often, well, it isn't going to end. Free memory, various buffer cache numbers, buffers in and buffers out, disk I.O. Again, here you can often see, okay, we seem to be reading a lot or we're writing a lot. If you're doing something like copying a file, you'll tend to see a large buffer out number and then maybe a bunch of small numbers. And then another large buffer out number and then zeros or ones sort of thing, because writes tend to happen not all the time, every now and again the writing is going on. These are various low level system numbers, which are, probably these numbers, it's a little bit hard to tell what's good and what's bad until you've got a lot of experience, but what it really comes down to is you look at it periodically, you get a feeling for what these numbers should look like and hope to spot when they're not like that. But essentially these are interrupts, context switches, user time, system time, idle time, waiting, ST. Signals, is it? Yeah, I can't remember. New edition. Every time you upgrade VMstat, they add another column, right? We didn't used to have weight like 3 years ago or something in the standard VMstat. So it's gradually, ST is a new one for me. But if you're looking at performance sort of stuff. Yes? Anyway. Right? It comes with a manual page. Good question. There is a subtle difference, and I'm not going to attempt to explain it because I'm not entirely clear on it. Wow, I'm so much clearer. There you go, time stolen from a virtual machine. Bidel had to look it up too, right? He wasn't just telling us that because he knew it. Okay. Yeah, there is a subtle difference here, and I'm not 100% clear myself. I always have to look it up when I'm trying to work out if it's important or not. But what this is really telling us is there's a bunch of disk I/O going on. There's a bunch of reads going on, particularly, that are quite happily able to sit in RAM because I'm reading the same information over and over again, and it's not changing. It doesn't have to be flushed out to the disk and reread and so on. So again, this system is pathetic because there's nothing going on it at the moment. But I will give an example of this stock exchange system beyond a... Yes, sir? Yes, I'm getting an average of the... since the system... Yeah, well, it's since the system started or something, isn't it? So the, it's a good summary of so far. And as I said, the system's doing nothing, so the numbers are not particularly helpful. But we can see from when I was running it, up here, pointing to this monitor doesn't do anything. When I was running it up here, these numbers weren't changing at all. And this stock exchange system, beyond once we got to the end of the day's trading on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, the database wasn't really being updated at all. Like the daily database wasn't being updated at all. Like no stocks were changing. We basically had that database because these machines had truckloads of RAM in it. The whole database was basically in buffer cache. It wasn't doing any disk I/O at all in the last, basically from about 8 or 9 o'clock at night until about 5, 6 a.m. the next morning. System did hardly any disk I/O because it was being used a lot, but all this stuff was in memory. So amount of free memory is usually pretty important, and it can get down low. Like don't panic if your system is using close to all of its memory. This might just be you resource things just right. But if you're expecting a bit of a spike, again, panic's the wrong word, but be aware. You first, yes, sir. Yes. On this machine, hopefully it's gonna tell me it's a gig.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the bottom line, like you're basically, as you said, nothing.
Yeah, nothing's happening here. But the point I want to go on to, and I don't want to make this into a lesson on VMstat, but the point here is if you're seeing, for example, a swap happening, it's probably time to think about what are my memory resources, because that's slowing the system down. And again, trade-offs here. Can I afford to put more memory in? Usually increasing RAM is not too bad a thing, even on hosted systems. It's a little bit, a few extra bucks a month to get some more memory. But it can be a deal. Am I doing a lot of reading and writing over time? So have a look at your system when it's in a normal running state. Get a feel for what these numbers should look like. And then when it's in a bad state, you'll be able to have a look and say, hey, I understand what's going on here. Stupid open office has gone back to the start. Yes. PCAT is one I thought I'd throw in there because over time I've got a lot of use out of it, and this is very much aimed at the more advanced members of the audience. The Coroner's Toolkit is a fairly handy set of applications written by Vitsa Venema and our partner, Dan Farmer, thank you. Something that's in my tongue there. They have done a lot. It's very good for incident response, post-mortem analysis on systems, things like that. But PCAT in particular is, if you're trying to look at a running system and work out why on earth is it using all of this memory? I wrote this thing, it shouldn't be this bad. Bitter experience, again. PCAT is a very handy thing for basically dumping the memory, the process space of the system. You actually get a snapshot of the memory, and then you can troll through it and go, what's this 30 megabyte string doing in here? Could I maybe get away with not having that? Why am I trying to copy 5 gigabytes of data in memory here? So PCAT is handy. If you're really down to that level, you've got interesting problems, but it's a very handy tool for getting an absolute snapshot of here's what's going on. Also in that department, we'll put S-Trace and L-Trace and various tools like this for looking at running programs. But I thought I'd mention PCAT because it's not something that's on a standard system, it's something that not everyone's necessarily heard of, and if you ever do need to get a snapshot of your processor's memory, it's people who need it go, oh, I wish I'd known about that earlier. Wget, curl, command line tools for just getting downloading something over HTTP, very useful if you're trying to work out why isn't this particular page, I thought I was should be getting better caching support here. Let's look at the headers, right? Okay, I can do it in my browser sometimes, but if there's redirects going on or something, Why does it seem like I'm being redirected so many times when I'm doing this page? Using wget or curl to download the page and look at the HTTP headers gives you a very good idea. Why is this web page crashing Firefox? Wget to a file and explore. Firebug and YSlow sort of belong together, I guess. If you're using Firefox, Firebug is a very handy, and I'll give a demonstration of this later on, very, very handy tool for, it's a extension for Firefox, for basically examining everything about the web page. It's the kind of Venkman debugger that built into the to the browser and extension with a bit much friendlier. It can also do performance analysis is the important thing. It will actually say, as I download the page, how many requests are being made, how long is it taking to download this particular component. Again, think of your standard sort of, I don't know, a blog page or something. You've got 57 images on there, 13 CSS files, a couple of JavaScript files, and so on. By the time you hook in all the, this JavaScript file makes calls out to retrieve that photo and that photo and that photo and so on, it's not too hard to mess up and end up with like 150 requests going on for a web page and it takes 48 seconds to load or something. Firebug is actually very useful for that. You sort of hit the net performance button and load the page and you chunk. Oh my gosh, I've got to make that faster. YSlow is a extension for this that the Yahoo team released. They actually announced it back at OSCON last year, which essentially looks at, and I'll give you a demonstration of this at the end, but it looks at a page and essentially gives it a grade from A through to F. Pretty hard to get an F to. I think you have to try really hard to get an overall F. But it, on about, what is it, 13 or 15 different components, it rates you A to F, and it varies, is the problem. They've added and dropped the components over time. But it looks at things like, you've put your CSS files early, which is good. You've put a lot of your JavaScript late in the file, which is good. You're loading 47 items, which maybe you want to reduce that. That's not so good. You're loading things from content delivery networks, which means caching effects kick in, which is something I'll get to later. And it's very handy for, you don't trust it implicitly. Like, it's not necessarily worth rigging the whole thing to get an A, but it's worth having a look at each of the components going, okay, I understand why I'm not getting a perfect mark on this one. There's some disagreement over how they graded e-tag support, for example. They actually penalized you for having good e-tags at one point. And so it's not necessary, but it's a good tool for looking at what's going on.
That could be quite good for micromanaging the human staff.
Why slow? certainly, I put it in mail a fair bit. AB, which is the ever descriptive name for the Apache benchmarking tool that comes with usually the Apache develop package, I think, is just a very handy tool for, again, you're developing something, maybe you're running it in a virtual machine on your desktop system, because it's very easy to test things to destruction when they're being run in a virtual machine, because it's already running a lot slower than on real hard. So you can try and really overload it and see what happens. AB is a very handy tool for saying, get this page 1,000 times, measure how long it takes, measure the average, measure the variation and so on. But you can also run it against production sites. You can run it from multiple machines, multiple threads at once and so on. The AB is a tool that if you know it's around, it's fairly easy to use and so on, very descriptive help pages and documentation. If you don't know it's there, it's handy to know it exists.
One tool that Bobby Bellman at this point is ApacheCup.
Yep.
It provides hits and referring hosts and also web server resources.
Yeah, ApacheCup is for actually taking a snapshot of the essentially the currently running Apache state on the system.
Finding out that Apache is getting blocked up because
yes. Yeah, that's true. Actually, I probably should have put Apache top here. It's very much in this section of the world, the live analysis area. I've just suffered a mental blank. What time am I aiming to finish? I know. 12:30, is it?
12:20. 12.
Yep. Okay, cool. Finally, and again, this is more in the PCAT area of expertise, PROCPID maps is essentially a memory layout, if you like, of, this one's going to be easy to show. If you need to be diving into PROCPID maps, you've got problems, but like, so PID here just means pick a process ID. And we can see here, fairly involved list of all the different shared libraries, how their address ranges, what their permissions are, and so on. From this and a fair bit of Googling around, and there are a few tools that make life easier, and I unfortunately have neglected to put their names down because I keep forgetting them, that actually make nice summaries of this. But this can give you an idea of snapshotting a running process. You're essentially looking at, my gosh, it's loading a lot of libraries, and so many of them appear to be private memory space. Why isn't more information being shared here between the, this is meant to be a shared library, damn it. Why is it? And so if you're really down to the, why is my process taking up so much memory? What's going on? What's actually loaded at this moment in time? Like, you can see here a fairly standard GNOME, and I'm going to say problem, but it's just life in the fast lane. There's a lot of libraries involved. And it's hard to avoid that necessarily. So don't panic. Just know how to use it if you need it. Now we're into trade-offs area, I guess. These are pretty much the axes that you get to play with. If you're, I need to fix a problem, what are the things I can do? My site is running slow. Not good enough. Why is your site running slow? It's CPU bound, okay? You can increase the CPU. Maybe you need more memory because actually you've got enough memory for doing the computations you need, but more buffer cache would be handy because it turns out your data isn't changing very often. So once you read it into memory and buffer cache, you might as well just, if you could keep it there, that'd be good. Maybe you don't have enough disk space. That's usually a fairly catastrophic problem. You don't get subtle failures due to not enough disk space. Things break in interesting ways. My favorite error message that I've ever seen on a live system was warning, /var has no more SPAT, or is running low on SPAT. And it stopped right there. But that's a case where, okay, /var log in this case was running out of space, had run out of space, past tense. But it's not going to necessarily grind the system to a halt, but you are maybe going to lose information. Maybe you need more disk space. Maybe you're running an upload site. Up to this point in time, you've got enough disk space, you're about to become more popular for some reason. More people are going to be uploading their movies or photos or whatever. Better plan ahead and get disk space, because it's sometimes not easy to add disk space quickly, depending on the setup you've got. I did some consulting for a site last year where they were essentially running a media upload type of site, and everything was going fine. They were getting new to release, and I actually sent the mail saying, remember how we talked about don't forget to bring on the disk array before you go live? Have you done it? And got back the whoops reply. This is, I don't know, an hour and a half after they gone live, but they did remember to turn on, because they'd been testing with a much smaller size disk because they needed to keep resetting it and going back, but they did remember to turn on the big honking great disk. Network traffic is something that maybe you can control. Maybe you're happy for that to be the limiting step. It's often one of the more expensive things about hosting. But a lot of hosting plans are quite reasonable too. They don't charge you for the maximum bandwidth that you achieve in the month because it's quite peaky. They'll charge you for the 95th percentile. They'll basically stack up all your network rate over the month, and 95% of it falls below this mark. How high was that? Okay, that was below your cap. You don't get charged extra. So you have brief amounts of peaky performance are okay. Consistent amount of going over your level is not so cool. Network traffic, again, can often be, well, traded with the last item, with money, to increase it. Maybe you're happy for it to be a limiting step. It's hard to tell. It's also one of the ones that you really often don't realize you need until well after the moment that you needed it. Your site is just inaccessible for some reason. Timeliness, by which I mean, this is sort of getting into the caching thing. If one way to serve information that takes a while to generate is to cache it. Next slide, I think, or two slides talks about caching, but there's different sort of points at which you can cache something. You can cache the bits of a page locally and then assemble them all very fast. You could use HTTP caching so that the information gets spread out all around the world. You could use something like Akamai if you're a really big guy to share things out geographically. But on all those levels, anytime you're introducing caching, you're trading off timeliness because the information in the cache is pretty much by definition slightly stale. How stale are you willing to let it be? If you're doing things I did last summer, caching forever is fine. If you're doing stock prices from today, not so much on the caching. There's always the trade-off there. Reliability is an interesting one. Many people are going to be thinking, why would I trade reliability for anything? But it could come the moment that the machine you're using is absolutely flat out and can't go any faster. Everything's quite slow. Okay, let's try and split things off. Unfortunately, the only other machine I've got to move something off isn't always available, or it may be on a slower network link. But I can live without necessarily having all of the images loading on the page immediately every time I change them. Caching will help me a bit there. I'm willing to trade overall performance on the site for sacrificing 10% of it to every now and again having a missing image or waiting till the caching. Essentially, I'm trading timeliness and reliability for speed there a little bit. Consistency. This is, again, maybe you think it's not, why on earth would you want inconsistent data? Google results, Google search results are actually a pretty good example of inconsistent data. You do a search, your buddy down the road does a search for the same thing, you don't necessarily see the same page because they're coming from different servers. And caching helps. Caching works here a bit too. If you've got something that's spread out over a number of different caches, particularly at the HTTP caching level, things are spread out over many caches around the world, you update whatever the thing is, an image, it's going to take some time to spread out over these caches, depending on how long you've set the expiry time to. If you've set the expiry time to a couple of hours, then it could take a couple of hours for these things, a couple of weeks, whatever. Everyone knows this when they're, I'll get to you in a minute, yep. Everyone knows this if you've been a sysadmin and forgotten to update the DNS records, which might have a couple of days timeout on them or something. Suddenly you've got to wait a couple of days for everyone to get the hint that your domain name now points over there. But again, with certain pieces of information, like I'm changing the image in the banner on my blog, it probably doesn't matter that everyone sees the update at the same moment. I can trade consistency for caching benefits, which reduces network traffic and so on. So, up the back. Could be too, yeah. You're basically hitting a farm of servers, right? They're not, Google says this, they're not going to give you the same results every time because their machines hold different information. Yes? Yeah, I guess that's true too. So, but that there's an example of where consistency is traded off for practicality, for, and in some cases for personalization purposes. And the final one is always the big elephant in the room. Most of these problems can be solved with more or less numbers of dollar signs. And although we're talking about the one-man band operations here, it is worth thinking sometimes for an extra $10 a month or $20 a month, you can double your disk space or buy more disk space so that suddenly on another machine so that you can suddenly start doing backups to another machine at your hosting provider. Also an important point to consider. Is this the right slide? Yeah, okay, it's probably not a bad point. Apparently because you've all been so good, you get a 5-minute reprieve. But yeah, let's have a quick break for a minute and try and start again in about 25:02. Okay?